keeping everybody, and I'd also like to thank the organisers of this very nice symposium this evening, David, Donna, Mary and Matt. Thank you very much. This is an incredible opportunity for all of us. I am actually a physician and endocrinologist in New York, in private practice. I also work in collaboration with people at Weill Cornell Medical College to bring medical students and residents to Ithaca for their education in primary care. I came across the fracking issue by honest means. A patient asked me during his or her office visit, "You're an endocrinologist. How is fracking going to affect our health and how humans work in our bodies?" This talk is an attempt to answer my patient's question. She posed this question at the beginning of December 2009. I'd spent that year as president of the medical staff at the Cayuga Medical Center. Any of you who've had the privilege to serve on a medical executive committee knows the commitment of time and energy required. This was on top of a busy clinical life, with my day starting with ward rounds at the hospital from 7 to 9, followed by office hours, an on-call schedule of 1 in 3, and 3 teenagers at home. Hence, I hadn't had much time to read the Ithaca Journal that year, and I thought that the signs that started appearing in front of people's homes with the word frack and a line struck through it were a reference to the new series Battlestar Galactica. However, with due diligence, I looked upon endocrine disease and hydraulic fracturing on Google and came up with a case history from Laura Amos, who lived within 1,000 feet from a gas drilling site in Garfield County, Colorado, who developed an adrenal adenoma and primary aldosteronism. Well, case reports on blogs are not included in the standard pyramid model of evidence-based medicine. So, I next came across TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, Theo Coburn's website that includes a detailed explanation of the term endocrine disruption and a section on gas drilling. This site contains spreadsheets of chemicals used in the fracking process and whether or not they are candidates for causing adverse health effects as well as endocrine disruption. I next went to PubMed and typed in endocrine disruption and review. In the first page, I came across a June 2009 Endocrine Society scientific statement entitled Endocrine Disrupting Chemicals, lead authored by Andrea Gore, a leader in the field. This article introduced me to a whole new branch of my profession I had not previously recognized at conferences, as it hadn't seemed relevant to my clinical practice. At the end of this excellent review article, the authors concluded, "In the absence of direct information regarding cause and effect, the precautionary principle is critical to enhancing reproductive and endocrine health." This statement was my introduction to the precautionary principle. The idea has had an enormous influence on my way of thinking about these issues. In this talk, section 1 is entitled, "What does evidence-based medicine have to say about fracking?" Section 2, "How the dose doesn't always make the poison." Section 3, "Turning imponderables into numbers, risk analysis and the precautionary principle." I will wrap up my talk with a take-home message. What does evidence-based medicine have to say about fracking? There is remarkably little published information about hydraulic fracturing on human health. My collaborator, Madeline Finkel, Professor of Clinical Public Health at Weill Cornell Medical College, has published extensively on a wide variety of public health issues and healthcare policy. In addition, as part of her responsibility as department course director, in close collaboration with medical librarians, she teaches medical students and physicians evidence-based medicine. She and I co-authored a paper, a peer-reviewed commentary in the American Journal of Public Health, entitled "The Rush to Drill for Natural Gas, a Public Health Cautionary Tale." This was pre-released in an electronic form on the American Journal of Public Health website and is due to come out in print version in May. This is the first discussion to appear on fracking in the medical literature. In it, we provide a general introduction to the economic potential and the process of unconventional natural gas extraction. We also identify the only systematic review that partially addresses the health effects. Our conclusions are much the same as you will hear in this talk. Dr. Roxana Witter is the lead author of this review from a collaboration of the Colorado School of Public Health and the Colorado State University. This excellent white paper was commissioned by the Natural Resource Defense Council and posted on their website. These authors used a broad, explicitly described series of medical subject headings or mesh descriptors spanning oil and gas development, but restricted itself to the five-year time window 2003 to 2008. Their terms included gasoline, vehicle emissions. Since there are no mesh descriptors for fracking or unconventional gas drilling, they searched PubMed using the term frack $ and created mesh descriptors derived from the search. From their initial haul of 5,063 papers, they reduced these to 831 references they reviewed. They divided these into 15 categories, including diesel exhaust, particulate matter, and social psychological. One of these headings was fracking. The search identified 234 initial fracking references, and after applying reasonable exclusion criteria, they were left with a total number of zero references for further review for fracking. The authors examined each of the remaining categories that were not unique to fracking and conclude reasonably enough, as discussed in the medical and public health literature review, few studies have been published on the health effects of oil and gas exploration and extraction on communities living and working in the vicinity of these activities. A lack of specific scientific evidence, however, does not negate the fact that oil and gas operations use and produce toxic contaminants that adversely affect human health. They go on to state, the available literature demonstrates a range of health effects. Moreover, they suggest further research is needed to assess the health impact of oil and gas operations on surrounding communities. Last month, Jake Hayes, a senior graduate student at the University of Montana in Missoula, under the supervision of Madeline Finkel and myself, conducted a systematic search of the medical literature looking for quality publications to review about the health effects of fracking. We searched for studies in PubMed, ToxNet, ISI Web of Science, National Center for Biotechnology Information, National Technical Information Service, Agricola, LexisNexis, Google Scholar, and Dogpile. Our search terms were broad. Natural gas brings up fossil fuels as a mesh term, but hydraulic fracturing itself has to be searched for as text words. There are no particular studies in these databases addressing hydraulic fracturing. We came up with not a single research paper addressing this issue. The absence of literature has the merit of being quick to read, but we concluded it is difficult to write a systematic review of the literature in the absence of any scientific papers. There is one other paper on this issue. It is slated for publication in October or November of this year in the Journal of Toxicology and Environmental Health. It is entitled Natural Gas Operations from a Public Health Perspective, and the lead author is Theo Cobar. There is a link on the TEDx website allowing us to review this paper. Dr. Coburn and her co-workers collected together their best guess lists for fracking chemicals based upon, predominantly upon entries in MSDSs provided by the energy industry. The veracity of this information is open to question, but this is not the fault of the authors, who have to infer the names of these chemicals as industry will not cooperate. The medical safety data sheet search identified 944 products. From these, there were 632 chemicals named. Finally, 353 unique chemicals with CAS numbers were selected as the basis for investigating their toxicological properties. These authors searched PubMed and ToxNet to create a database. According to these authors, 37% of these chemicals can affect endocrine organs, 52% the nervous system, 40% the immune system, 46% the cardiovascular system and blood, 25% are potential mutagens or could cause cancer. I won't read any more from their list, but it appears that many of these agents require more detailed studies of their ability to cause harm. how the dose doesn't always make the poison. The EPA defines an endocrine disruptor as an exogenous agent that interferes with the synthesis, secretion, transport, binding, action, or elimination of natural hormones in the body which are responsible for the maintenance or homeostasis, reproduction, development, and or behavior. There is now a long list of agents that fulfill these criteria. Well-known examples include diethylstilbestrol, DDT, phthalates, bisphenol A, PCBs, and phytoestrogens. There are several features I would like to highlight about endocrine disruption that make it a particularly complex process to study, and which also run counter to the usual approach when we think about toxins. Philip von Hockenheim, better known as Paracelsus, is credited with the phrase, "dose makes the poison." Endocrine-disrupting chemicals defy this principle by operating at extremely low concentrations. In fact, many do not display the usual monotonic dose-response curves. Some are more effective at lower rather than higher concentrations. Hence, the presence of endocrine-disrupting chemicals in parts per trillion or to parts per billion can cause major biological effects. The timing of endocrine disruption can be crucial. There are critical developmental windows when pathways are sensitive to signal disruption. There may be considerable period of latency between the initial exposure of the organism to the endocrine disrupting chemical and the observable effect on the organism. In some cases, this latency can last as long as decades. In fact, increasingly, epigenetic mechanisms, which are mechanisms that modify DNA without changing its sequence, are being found to play a key role in transmitting signal transduction occurring at critical developmental window to progeny cells, many cell divisions later, in fully differentiated tissues. These epigenetic mechanisms include DNA methylation or demethylation, histone acetylation, and very likely small RNA interference. The same endocrine disrupting molecule may have effects upon multiple physiological pathways affecting the reproductive organisms, metabolism, the gastrointestinal system, and the lungs. Each of these effects have their own unique timing. Complex mixtures of endocrine disruptors may have synergistic effects, for example, one enhancing another's concentration by affecting its metabolism or its protein binding. Finally, in some instances, epigenetic modification of germ cell DNA has been demonstrated to lead to transgenerational transmission of DNA modifications. At present, our ability to identify candidate endocrine disruptors from the lists of chemicals used in fracking fluid or that are identified in flowback or produced waters is based merely upon whether there are references in the published medical literature suggesting an effect on endocrine or other systems. The EPA has produced a process for the rigorous screening of environmental chemicals, but there is no plan to investigate those involved in fracking. In particular, there is no infrastructure available at present to screen chemicals in fracking fluid for their effect on development. Although there are many hurdles to identifying these compounds, we need to be careful that future generations do not pay dearly for our ability to use and profit from natural gas extracted in this fashion. Turning imponderables into numbers, risk analysis, and the precautionary principle. The fracking enterprise owes its existence not only to the development of technology, but also to a permissive removal of federal legislation freeing the energy development corporations from prohibitively costly oversight. The legislative act culminated in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, removing from fracking the provisions of the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. Also, the Surplus Superfund Act does not cover fracking sites. This effectively devolves regulation to the states, and hence there's been a piecemeal approach to regulation or the issuing of permits by the affected gas shale states. This has freed the energy industry from the responsibility of divulging the chemicals they add to millions of gallons of water used in hydraulic fracturing. This in turn has led to what has been described as a gas rush. In recent months, there have been an attempt to improve the transparency of the gas drilling process. Halliburton has declined to abide by a subpoena from the EPA to disclose their list of chemicals. However, this hasn't stopped the industry from appearing magnanimous in providing selective lists of chemicals to calm the public. For example, Halliburton put up a plush website listing what's in the fluids in Pennsylvania. This includes constituents as acetic acid, CAS number 64-19-7, with a helpful common use, processed fruit, cheese, meat, and poultry. And alcohol C14-C15 ethoxylate, called polyoxyalkylene, CAS number 68951-67-7, common use, liquid detergent, disinfectant, toilet cleaner, and stain remover. Who could object to these domestic helpers? More recently, the combined industry groups, the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, the Groundwater Protection Council, have announced their intention to post online a registry of fracking chemicals mid-April. That means now. 75 companies, 80% of energy and petroleum companies, have stated they will be part of this initiative. However, they are not planning to provide information about chemicals that they consider to be part of their competitive advantage. So this begs the $64,000 question. How will we know how much information is missing? Further, who are the 20% of corporations not currently participating? The FRAC Act, the Obama administration, the EPA have all required industry to disclose these chemicals. But at present, the political will is absent from restoring these provisions originally contained in the Safe Drinking Water Act. As a result, the information about the chemicals is indirectly derived from medical safety data sheets. These often contain brand names and not the unique CAS numbers. The industry can therefore maintain deniability and state that any particular noxious substance identified in this fashion is inaccurate or has long since been discontinued. Risk analysis itself is an enormous field I'm just beginning to explore. In just one form, probabilistic risk analysis, the severity of each potential adverse effect is multiplied by the likelihood of occurrence of each of the negative outcomes. I do believe the weighing of benefits and costs is of great importance. Some consider the likelihood of leaking during horizontal hydraulic fracturing process itself as a surrogate measure for environmental health risk. Proponents like to point out the extraordinary safety of this process. Even if you ignore the cogent criticisms of this complacency from engineers and geologists, this narrow definition of risk does not take into account the total lifetime of the process from the clearing of acreage for the well pads to the disposal of wastewaters to the use of natural gas to heat our homes, cook our meals, or maybe one day propel our cars. The problem of risk analysis as applied to fracking is that there are just too many imponderables, too many unknowns. We don't know the identity of the chemicals employed in this process and are also not certain of the complex constituents found in the flowback and produced waters. So we cannot use our knowledge of classical toxicology to weigh the risks for each of these substances. In addition, the identification of individual endocrine disrupting chemicals takes a great deal of careful, basic laboratory research. To this list of uncertainties, I add the absence of soundly designed, well-executed epidemiological studies. I reject the use of surrogate measures, such as the probability of leaking, as a substitute for real biological outcomes. After much reflections, I still go back to the precautionary principle that is so similar in intention to an important principle from medical ethics. Primum non nocere, or first do no harm. As stated in the 1998 Wingspread version, where an activity raises threats of harm to the environment or human health, precautionary measures should be taken, even if some of the cause and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. In this context, the proponent of an activity rather than the public bears the burden of proof. The process of applying the precautionary principle must be open, informed, and democratic, and must include potentially affected parties. It must also involve an examination of the full range of alternatives, including no action. Owing to the actions of many physicians from upstate New York, several of whom may be present today, this precautionary principle in relation to fracking was heeded by the Supreme Council of the Medical Society of the State of New York on December the 9th, 2010. Resolved that the Medical Society of the State of New York supports a moratorium on natural gas extraction using high-volume hydraulic fracturing in New York State until valid information is available to evaluate the process for its potential effects on human health and the environment. Take-home message. In this talk, I've brought together several themes concerning the health effects of fracking. First, there are no well-conducted epidemiological studies addressing the safety of this industry to human health. Second, although we have a large body of literature about classical toxicology involved in the adverse health effects of chemical exposure, we are only now beginning to learn about other processes, such as endocrine disruption, that do not follow this classical model. Thirdly, the removal of prudent federal regulations and also the lack of transparency within the industry, alongside the void of medical literature on the health effects of fracking, leads us to invoke the precautionary principle. In my opinion, this moratorium should not just be the privilege of New York State, but should be global. It should remain in place until we have clear evidence that fracking is safe. Alternatively, if fracking is found to be unsafe, as many suspect it is, we should be prepared to ban the practice. In view of the fact... In view of the fact that the horse has already bolted in many states, closing the regulatory barn door is unlikely to happen. Hence, as a profession, it is our job to design and conduct robust epidemiological studies. But this will take time, and until then, I propose that these vast trapped shale gas resources should remain a large potential energy store that our children or our children's children may one day choose to use with greater knowledge and better judgment than we have now. To reply to my patient's question, we are currently ignorant of the health effects of fracking, and even more ignorant about...
We're all getting a little tired, maybe a little stretch is in order. Here's the home stretch here. So there was one word that Adam, one phrase Adam used, which is MSDS, and that might not be something familiar to everyone. It stands for Material Safety Data Sheet. I work in a laboratory, I run a laboratory, every time I order a chemical, it has associated with an MSDS sheet that has variable depths of information on it. But the thing to remember about MSDS sheets, which is a certain amount of what we're basing, how we're discussing this problem, is it's based on exposing largely animals to a single compound. It doesn't really consider what happens when an organism is exposed to multiple compounds. Just thought that was a useful point to raise.
How this process may affect the hormone system of the body, but my colleagues and I will join together to answer your questions.